Thank you, Melanie, for the introduction to Barbara and to me. I'm delighted to be back here after all these years. First time back in Austin since we left. For me, not for Barbara. And on this very auspicious occasion, this Pentecost Sunday, just in case you didn't know, the 50th day after Easter. And since I'm going to talk a little bit about that too, I thought I would start with the story. This will serve as our invocation. From the book of Acts, King James Version, about Pentecost, chapter 2 here. And when the day of Pentecost was fully come, they were all with one accord in one place, when suddenly there came a rush, a sound of, as from heaven, as of a rushing mighty wind, and it filled all the house where they were sitting. And there appeared unto them cloven tongues, like as of fire, and it sat upon each of them, and they were all filled with the Holy Ghost, and began to speak with other tongues, as the Spirit gave them utterance. And there were dwelling in Jerusalem Jews, devout men, out of every nation under heaven. Now when this was noised abroad, the multitude came together, and they were confounded, because that every man heard them speak in his own language. And they were all amazed and marveled, and saying to one another, Behold, are these not which speak all Galileans? And how hear we every man in our own tongue wherein we were born? And I'll skip the part about all the nations that are then named. And they were all amazed, and they were in doubt, saying to one another, What meaneth this? Others mocking said, These men are full of new wine. But Peter, standing up with the 11, lifted up his voice and said unto them, Ye men of Judea and all that dwell in Jerusalem, be this known unto you, and hearken to my voice. For these are not drunken, as you suppose, seeing it is but the third hour of the day. But this is that which was spoken by the prophet Joel. And it shall come to pass in the last days, saith God, that I will pour out my Spirit on all flesh. And your sons and your daughters shall prophesy, and your young men shall see visions, and your old men shall dream dreams. And on my servants and on my handmaidens I will pour out in those days of my Spirit, and they shall prophesy. Some years later, James Luther Adams, about whom I'm speaking a bit today, wrote a book, which I edited, of the essays titled The Prophethood of All Believers. This is from an essay by James Luther Adams, a man referred to before and who will be referred to in the sermon, written in 1941, a few months before the outbreak of World War II, in the midst of that century, which saw at the time of the crisis, as he saw it, and as historians will see it, of the whole democratic and liberal spirit of the world. Theology, said James Luther Adams, in the language of St. Bonaventura, a medieval theologian, in the language of St. Bonaventura, is an affective science. That's A-F-F-E-C-T-I-V. Feelingful, affective science. The science, he said, of the love of God. And the function of the church is to bring people into communion with a group wherein the divine power of transformation and the ethical standards rooted in it are operative. When we say operative, we mean that this power is capable of changing people, of eliciting commitment to a way of life that makes a difference in their attitude toward themselves, others, and God. In short, it aids them in achieving a voluntary community. Only by some such commitment can we, in Channing's words, be always young for liberty. This element of commitment, of a change of heart, of decision, which is so emphasized in the Gospels, has been neglected by religious liberalism, and that is the prime source of its enfeeblement. We liberals are largely an uncommitted and therefore a self-frustrating people. Our first task then is to restore to liberalism its own dynamic and its own prophetic genius. We need conversion within ourselves. Only by some such revolution can we be seized by a prophetic power which will enable us to proclaim the judgment and the love of God. Only by some such conversion can we be possessed by a love that will not let us go. And when that has taken place, we shall know that it is not our own wills alone that have acted. We shall know that the ever-living Creator and Recreator has again been brooding over the face of the deep, and out of the depths has been bringing forth new life. Moments of meditation, prayer, and silence. Thou in whose circle of light our lives are drawn together, we offer the whole thanksgiving of our hearts for every gift of goodness and strength that we have received this day and every day of our lives. As we have received, so let us give. Be thou the perfect receiver of our every gift of life, our every offering of song, our singular acts of courage, of care, and of compassion. Good to be here again, as I said. I will pour out my spirit upon all flesh, and your sons and your daughters shall prophesy. Well, perhaps, but will your sons and daughters prophesy for a liberal faith, or might it be for some brand of, say, Pentecostalism? Will they abandon the liberalism of their upbringing for, say, some ecstatic and utterly certain faith where the word perhaps never occurs, or perhaps for the golf course and, heaven forfend, the Republican Party? A serious question underlies my jest, and excuse me for bringing in politics here, but will your children know that Pentecost is a central tradition sacred to this community of faith? Or that we even had such a thing as a faith as distinct from reasonable opinions, or a faith community as distinct from a gathering place of the already like-minded, and a sacred tradition as distinct from something just secular, just another meeting. It is the legacy of James Luther Adams, who many have called the most important Unitarian Universalist thinker of the past century. It was his legacy to hold our feet to the fire about many of these self-disabling tendencies of liberalism, as he identified them. The things that have helped the L word, as you know, become a kind of a byword of derision among its enemies, maddeningly, so that they get away with it. Adams spoke pointedly, as you heard, of liberalism's enfeeblement. He also sought out the philosophic and historical roots of its self-frustrating habits of heart and mind. He went on to show us a pathway back into the thicket of serious theological reflection, and as well as back into the public square where religion and politics are always intertwined, as our culture wars of recent vintage have so Ray Daly reminded us. And Adams did something more. He projected a vision of a more confident and inclusive, as it were, a more liberal faith, a liberalism that is genuinely transforming, being himself an immensely affective human being, a storyteller with great feeling. He was also immensely effective. He affected people and institutions. No wonder he commended the idea of theology that he found in St. Bonaventura of ancient times. Theology, curiously, as an affective science. Imagine that. A science of the love of God, which of course meant in the old sense of science, a systematic and well-reasoned knowledge. That's the kind of thing that Adams did, bringing up luminous words and phrases. This is the way that liberalism will be transformed, by firing the imagination with symbols which are themselves luminous, symbols which, as it were, light the way before us into the thickets of our personal and our public lives, symbols that enable us to venture more purposefully and more courageously onward. For example, Pentecost, a symbol of the rebirth of imagination itself, clothed in a story, an old story about one spirit embracing the many. Of course, we say it very prosaically, don't we? We speak frequently of unity in diversity. The artist Corita Kent said it with great enlivening imagination when she took the Pentecost story and she spoke. She said that the Spirit will descend not with tongues of fire, but with tons of fire, for what is most spiritual is most weighty, most affecting and affecting. And what defies reason, the love of God, may also liberate reason. Well, it's good to be back. According to Andre Malraux, ancient Gnostics said that the angels asked every dead person, "Where do you come from?" And I will have to answer, "Well, I come from, one of the places I come from is Austin. Austin, Texas." Now, notice, I didn't say came from, but come from. And I think we all have this sense that the places that have significantly affected our lives are places that we live with still. We come from there. Barbara and I and our two boys came here in 1972, back when it was a city of perhaps 200,000 souls or a few more. I'd say to people, "Well, what a nice town this is," thinking, of course, of the parks and the wonderful live oak trees and the drag with all those colorful hippies. Well, do we still have hippies today? I don't even know. They'd say, "Well, it was nice before it grew so big. It's about time, I think, that I got back after all these years to see if I recognize the place." And yes, I do recognize the place, including also house and hall and many faces among us here to this morning. We've weathered just a bit in this quarter century, haven't we? In 1978, for me, it was, that year carried me back to old Virginia, where I was born, somehow. But I must confess that some days I would remember old Austin, and I would say to myself, "Why did I ever leave that place? I really did." But I'm not just talking about Blue Bonnets and Barton Springs. I'm talking about the reaffirmation of my ministry and my own sense of relationship to the church that I found here among you after a time that I had experienced a crisis in my own personal sense of vocation. And when I say among you, it isn't just those among you who were here when I was here, but you who are a continuing community within this sacred tradition that I keep talking about. It's something we have to recover and treasure. You see, I'd come to Austin from an inner city ministry in Cleveland, Ohio, which was a brave experiment of several UU churches in that metropolitan area responding to the terrible urban crisis of the 1960s. We were among those inventing a community ministry before the UUA discovered its need for community ministers. But because we did not fit the usual inward-looking, self-contained congregational mold that we so talk about with our proud, independent, Unitarian spirit, the UUA did not want to call us, my partner and I, in that inner-city ministry, settled ministers at all. But we said, you have sent us on this errand into the urban wilderness, and the city itself is our parish. Affirming thereby the world to which our own religious community is inextricably related. We had a slogan for it in those days. We said, let the world set the agenda. A proud slogan. Not just we few, but the world itself in which something is happening and to which we must respond. Something hitherto not really quite imagined by our rational, responsible, right-thinking, liberal communities, who must now unlearn some of their proud assumptions about themselves and their unalloyed altruism in doing these good works for all those less fortunate people and so forth. Learning to turn around that way of thinking. The title of one book that we all read at that time summed it up. The Suburban Captivity of the Churches. We UUs, especially in the large metropolitan areas, had now discovered something that we ourselves needed to be liberated from. Our own captivity in the suburban existences that we had built around ourselves. And that's quite a come down, isn't it? For people who are proud of themselves to experience what Jim Adams called a change of heart, needing conversion within ourselves. There was also in this time an intense longing for a new social reality, a new covenant, racially, economically, and indeed environmentally. This was the time when Earth Day was born. Another of Gibson Winter's book titles, again, sums it up. The book was called The New Creation as Metropolis, celebrating the city in its very diversity, rather than trying to escape it and isolate yourself from it. A kind of consciousness-shaping prayer that the many, often clashing voices of the urban Babel, that this should be revisioned and even transformed into, as it were, a Pentecost of community-creating energy. But this early experiment, brave as it was, in transforming liberalism, was overwhelmed by everything that the 1960s has come to stand for in our minds and our memories. Conflict over race, conflict over Vietnam. Virtually all of our churches experienced internal conflict and incipient decline from the late 1960s. Austin somewhat escaped that, I think, but that's another larger historical question. After only 4 years in this brave little urban ministry in Cleveland, the whole thing came to an end, and, you know, it's a somewhat disillusioning experience, and I almost said goodbye ministry itself until I discovered, for the first time in my life, the rigors of unemployment with a couple of young kids at home to feed. And that changing careers in a Rust Belt city like Cleveland during a national recession of the early 70s wasn't so much fun. So small wonder that when you invited me to come to your ministry here, I was ready to make the leap, even into the vast unknown state, if not state of mind, of Texas. Barbara agreed, and the boys, well, as Robert Frost said, now mind you, this is not a liberal slogan, as Robert Frost would say, never give a child a choice. So what if the church was at the end of a dead-end street called Grover Avenue behind the State School for the Blind? There was a vast field of bluebonnets right out there. And that did get to me. Suddenly, an astonishingly diverse community with a warm, benign, unworried, really much more unhurried spirit opened up before me. As Walt Whitman would say, I loafed and invited my soul. I healed. I remember the woman barber, and I'd never had a woman cut my hair before. Isn't that amazing? She said to me, the trouble is you don't love your hair. An utterly new concept to this uptight guy from the Northeast. I think she meant, you know, loosen up. You know, she meant whatever she meant. I didn't forget it, though, did I? Don't get me wrong. There was work to do here in this church. I didn't just dust loaf. How many times did we go out and fix the roof, you know, that Rari wing with that had, used to have a nice flat roof, you know, that always sprung another leak, but we never had enough money, of course, to hire somebody to do it right. And our sanctuary, which was house and hall in those days, was so all-purpose. I used to say it had everything except lines painted on the floor and basketball hoops at either end. And maybe you remember the Mardi Gras Saturday night parties, celebrations, sponsored by the Brazilian Students Association, and you're going to get the picture, when we would rent out house and hall for a grand sum of $200 and think it was big bucks. Then the next morning, on the next Sunday, the next morning would be Sunday, and I'd be calling up Bill Biggs on the phone to get him to come over and help unclog the toilets. And we worshiped that morning with the sweet incense of stale beer still hanging in the air. These folk are not drunk, as you suppose. It's only 11 o'clock in the morning. And then there was Sunflower, Diana. Every Sunday night, year-round, talking about everything from transactional analysis to tarot cards to New Age astrology, I guess, and maybe Gnostic angelology, where do you come from, thrown in. And it was all equally true. And it felt good, so we did it. Such was our 70s credo. So willy-nilly, we were transforming liberalism. We went from believing in nothing in the 1960s to believing in everything in the 1970s. Uh-oh. Now, it's like, do I have to qualify that? James Luther Adams said that he learned from his professor of Shakespeare, the famous George Lyman Kittredge, that the art of teaching is the art of telling a lie and qualifying it. You have to tell the lie first to get, of course, to get the student's attention. I won't even try to qualify this little lie about how we change from believing in nothing to believing in everything, though a lot could be said about that. It's more fun if we just let our imaginations play with it for a while. What I'm saying is the times, they were a-changing and are a-changing even today, and we with them. Who is James Luther Adams? Well, very briefly, he was both a liberal activist and he was liberalism's severest critic, interested in everything, politics as much as religion. He was raised as a fundamentalist in rural Washington State. He became a Unitarian minister in the early days of the 20th century, and a little later he became a theological school professor, first in Chicago, a little later in the 1950s at Harvard, where I literally sat at his feet. With him, theology was indeed an affective, a feelingful science. He affected virtually everyone that he met. People are forever remembering him for the time that they met him, what he asked them, how he elicited something, some response from them. What great things we can learn that are not just book learning from such people. In a lifetime that virtually spanned the 20th century, a century that, as I mentioned, saw the rise and the fall of two great totalitarianisms, which are what? Two vast challenges to the whole liberal, cultural, and value ethos of the world. In that time, he saw our fate as religious liberals and our ability to respond to these challenges as closely tied to the fate of this broader liberalism itself. This was the central theme of this book. One of the central themes of this book I have written about his theology called Transforming Liberalism, just published last fall. Adams 2 is how I'll have to say to those angels, where I come from. I hope my reading from you before gave you a little taste of the man's thought and some of the bite of his rhetoric. He decries our tradition of rationalism and moralism. That is to say, our nice way of reducing religion to a few reasonable ideas. Only reasonable ideas may apply, that attitude, and moral ideals that feel comfortable because we ourselves, as good people, wear them. He speaks of our need then for conversion within ourselves, metanoia, calling for indeed a born-again faith in a way that shocked his Unitarian friends from the time he first started to talk this way. Especially because we thought that was something that only fundamentalists were interested in doing. Especially he speaks of commitment then, that which follows from a change of heart, the commitment that flows from knowing yourself to be the recipient of many mercies, many gifts, and therefore also the bearer of many life responsibilities. Saith the prophet Adams, this element of commitment, of change of heart, of decision, so much emphasized in the Gospels, has been neglected by religious liberalism, and that is the prime source of its enfeeblement. We liberals are largely an uncommitted and therefore a self-frustrating people. Now that is one of the most incisive criticisms from within, I think, that you will find. Now I want to perpetrate a few more lies of oversimplification in answer to the question I suppose you're itching to ask. Transforming liberalism, that sounds nice, but from what to what? Consider how we've changed, not just in the last two decades that I spoke about, the 70s and the 60s, but over the last two centuries. For shorthand, very shorthand now, looking at the clock. Think of these heroes of Unitarian Universalism, Thomas Jefferson, Ralph Waldo Emerson, and, we'll say, a collective mentality, and I couldn't think of one person to stand for this, the humanism with a capital H. From them, liberalism inherited three big ideas, rationalism, individualism, and secularism. To be sure, these are handy cudgels if the religious ills that you are fighting our ignorant superstition, our mindless conformism, our state-sponsored piety. Yes, but try to make up a positive religion out of these things, and we are left with what I would call three surefire losers in the phylogenetic history of religion. For they all proclaim so clearly what we do not believe rather than what we do, and that is the position in which we have been too often stuck. And who cares in the end about that? And no wonder they say, well, the L word. Let's look at these three moments in our liberal religious history, just to flesh this one out a bit. Enlightenment rationalism was great in its day. So it goes back into the 18th and early 19th century. It swept away the cobwebs of ancient prejudice and privilege. Thomas Jefferson really did think that the light of reason, once liberated from the shackles of hoary tradition, would sweep the nation, the new nation that he so loved. And within a generation, virtually all young men in America, he said this explicitly, would be Unitarians. course, he meant with a small u. We would adopt this rational new faith. We love the guy for this very audacity of thinking so. Then the benign, that believing in the benign, all-conquering power of reason, it's almost Pentecostal to think such a thing. But Jefferson's legacy is also then a religion so schooled in skepticism that it comes up with things that are just plain naive about human nature. Emerson came along then a generation later. Rational religion, as he saw it, had hardened into something that Emerson cruelly called the corpse-cold Unitarianism of Boston. Speaking of the Brahmins, Jim Adams loved telling the story of the Boston matron, the proper Bostonian matron, who said, "Why should I be born again? I was born in Boston." Jim loved those stories. Emerson enthroned self-reliant individualism. Whoso would be a man must be a nonconformist. Ah, we love it, but his transcendentalism then cut the apron strings, our apron strings, to church, to scripture, to history. He said, set aside your Bibles and read nature itself for your inspiration. Our legacy from Emerson is the one dogma of our, certainly dogma-free religion, individual freedom of belief, as if religion were a cafeteria laid out for something to, with something to pick from for all, and not a great table prepared by many ages, providing deep nourishment, going back to people like St. Bonaventura or Hildegard of Bingen, for example. Cultural historians see in Emerson the shift from in the Enlightenment age of reason to Romanticism, an age when feeling and intuition are seen as the chief lights. Jefferson believed in the self-evident truths of reason, including, indeed, innate human rights, and championed that. For Emerson, intuition, feeling, and inspiration become the oracles of truth, of the divine, speaking in the soul and to the soul. This was his transcendentalism. With an almost Pentecostal verve, he expressed this great truth that nothing great was ever achieved without enthusiasm. And we love him just for that. I call him St. Ralph Waldo. But his legacy was also this kind of proud, unbending, somewhat self-isolating individualism. Now, maybe not self-isolating, self-protective. Don't tread on me. When did the humanist movement begin? Well, hard to say, but it goes back to the late 19th century with the Free Religious Association among the children of the Transcendentalists, intellectuals who tried hard to build a new liberal religious community but couldn't quite subdue their egos long enough to finish the job, I would say. They left us with three big ideas. Emerson championed the individual who must rebel against the suffocating conformism of the small town life. But by the late 19th century, we were into an age of urbanism and the Industrial Revolution, of science and scientific humanism and social and Darwinism, as well as Darwinism itself. Free religion began to collapse the sacred into the secular, leaving everything secular, inviting us to cast off all illusions and save ourselves. The Humanist Manifesto in 1933 said it most clearly, science is the true standard of knowledge, and religion is at best a pretty metaphor. By the time I was in college then in the 1950s, the high priest of scientific psychology was B.F. Skinner, the only kind of psychology they really taught. And B.F. Skinner declared that we would not solve the world's ills, and he was a very serious intellectual, a man concerned about and perceptive about the world's ills, but we will not solve those ills, he said, until we rid ourselves of the last vestiges of pre-scientific thinking. The title of his book said it all again, beyond freedom and dignity. In other words, liberalism itself had finally, liberal religion had finally abolished itself, not just God and Jesus, but the illusions of freedom and human dignity themselves must be abolished for the simple and obvious reason that these are not scientific concepts. True. We might call humanism's leap of faith then into a kind of science-ruled utopia its way of, its idea of Pentecost. But, of course, a reaction was bound to set in, and that's what I was talking about before, and I referred to the transition from the 60s to the 70s in more recent history. With the discovery of humanistic psychologies, and also New Age thought, and also serious environmentalism, and serious, a more serious new hunger for spirituality, indeed among us who today find ourselves speaking, if we follow our view, a present Bill Sinkford, a language seeking a new language of reverence. These are the transformations that I believe we must seek if liberalism is to, as it were, be rescued from itself, from rationalism to a parabolic vision, reading sacred texts of every tradition with heart and mind equally intact. Second, then, from individualism to the dedicated community, for nothing great was ever achieved without a band of sisters and brothers who are really joined in a history-making mission and know it. Argue about it. Think about it. Do it. And third, from a secularism which forever seeks to cast off the past and move on to something new, to remembering once again where we came from, recalling once again our sacred tradition. For example, Pentecost and other luminous symbols of liberal faith. When we started lighting candles like this in the Arlington church that I served, that I left here, one old-time member was heard to mutter right there in the pew, "Everything but the Virgin Mary," she said. Maybe she was right. Okay, I saw a bumper sticker just the other day. I could see inside the car that they were Mennonites, peacenik Mennonites in that car. The bumper sticker said, "Our God is an awesome God." Oh, yes, I recalled. Where did that line come from? That's what Barack Obama said at the National Democratic Convention last summer, before the debacle in which liberals discovered once again that they could not, figure out how to speak an authentic language of faith, and therefore they could not win trust of millions of American voters. There's my political analysis for the morning of the last election. I think that Obama meant something quite simple and clear and wonderful, and we should be able to hear it. He meant that we liberals believe in a power that is sacred and sovereign, that is at work in history, that is the community-making power, as Jim Adams called it, that is most visibly seen in the global struggle for justice, for mercy, and for peace. A power in which we stand in awe. Toward which we hold genuine reverence. We need to relearn this language. We can learn from Jim Adams loads of things about religion, going beyond the old rational critique and beyond the old individual self-protective attitude and into the rediscovery of sacred tradition. For example, Pentecost could be the most important religious holiday in a religious calendar because, after all, it says exactly what we talk about all the time. We talk about diversity and unity within our diversity. And indeed, the miracle of the fact that the greater the diversity we hold within these walls, the greater, the more miraculous our unity when we discover it. But that means we have to be, in a very deep level, dedicated to it. In that day I will pour out my spirit upon all flesh. Yes, but the line I like, Prophet Joel, is where you said, and your old men shall dream dreams. It gives old, you know what's like me, a piece of the action. So thank you, Davidson, and thank you, congregation, for having me back. Vladimir Nabokov called his autobiography, Speak, Memory. Isn't that wonderful? His autobiography, Speak, Memory. My memory has spoken richly to me here among you this weekend. And now I will better know what to say when the angels ask, where from? Beach